Politicians love it because it allows them to have an existential crisis, and an existential crisis requires existential solutions.
My guest today is Ken DeGraff.
Thanks for letting me join you this morning. I am a first-term from House District 22 for the Colorado General Assembly. So Air Force retired and commercial pilot right now, but most of my time seems to be taken up with House of Representatives stuff. I've seen your, you know, some of your podcasts, great stuff with, obviously with Dr. Lindzen, Dr. Happer. And so anything that I might say that would be different than what they say is the default goes to them. There's no question as to that. My goal here is to dumb climate scientists down to politician level. So if you're familiar with the, are you smarter than a fifth grader? You have to go down a little lower than that to get to politician level. Because politicians, they have a, they want to believe. They want to believe it because it gives them all kinds of license to do all sorts of things. So anyways, so just trying to make it, get it to a point where they can actually understand it. So just some intro quotes: the great tragedy of science is the slaying of a beautiful theory by an ugly fact. And we need to get back to empirical science, or what I'd say, make science science again. Empirical science is observable, testable, repeatable, and it has to be falsifiable. Everything can't point to the conclusion. And I call this presentation "The Sky Is Falling" because Chicken Little. The best way to I don't know if everybody's familiar with the story anymore after it's been Disneyfied, but. It did not end well for Chicken Little's friends, and it was not about barn animals. It was about human nature, and so it was some ancient wisdom about human nature. And the surest way to learn the value of old wisdom is to forget it. So, and here's just my slide as far as what I'm going to tell you, and the gullibility kills. One, we should trust the science. A greenhouse gas, it's mostly, just for definitions, it's mostly transparent to incoming shortwave, high energy radiation. So that's really cool. The sunlight comes through the atmosphere with basically no interference. And it's somewhat opaque to outgoing long wave, low energy radiation. So it doesn't trap, the atmosphere does not trap heat. All what it does is it slows it down, very much like insulation in your house. And CO2, and we'll get into this, is less than 10% of the greenhouse gas effect, where water vapor is greater than 90%. It's like 7% and 93%. So, and then the other stuff is barely even there. Humans make about 30 gigatons of carbon dioxide in a year, but there are over 3,000 gigatons in the atmosphere. And so we have to look at that percentage. So that's only about 1%. 1% of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere comes from humans. And the U.S. is about 15% of that. And a state, say Colorado, is about 2% of that. New York City would be about 5%. New York State, I'm sorry. So if you look at that and you go 2% of 15% of 1% of 10% is 3 one-millionths. Three parts in 1 million. In 1 million of the greenhouse gas effect could be attributed to Colorado. And then if you divide that by another 6 million, then you'd get the individual contribution. But the zeros get a little bit ridiculous. So bottom line is that the impact of going net zero is nothing. There's no benefit to it. And Dr. Happer explains that in his congressional testimony, that it's a bit player. And the IPC talked about in climate research modeling that we're dealing with a coupled, nonlinear, chaotic system, and therefore the long-term prediction of future climate states is not possible. Yet, we are making policy based on what is not possible from the IPCC, and we're using the IPCC's political reports to do it. So from Dr. Lindzen, you've interviewed him, so I won't go into this, but... obviously, one of the leading experts and actually visible experts on climate and climate change, as opposed to nebulous ones hiding behind IPCC reports. But anyways, the calls to limit carbon dioxide emissions are more premature than they were 25 years ago. So kind of like the more we learned about this, the more we learn it's not an issue. And then also from Dr. Happer, that the cause, the CO2 is wildly exaggerated. In this, the 90% greenhouse gas warming is due to water vapor and clouds. Carbon dioxide is a bit player. The current warming period began in 1800, and I'll talk about that, long before there was any appreciable CO2. And one thing I thought was interesting from as we get into this chatbot is somebody, it's I liked this quote by what I thought was Dr. Sowell, what I think is Dr. Sowell, that's what it was given to me as, global warming due to greenhouse gases is the latest in a long series of one-factor theories about a multi-factor world. Such theories have often enjoyed great popularity, despite how often they turned out to be wrong. Now, I think that's Dr. Sowell, but I wanted to check, so I looked it up. And when I looked it up, the AI bot gave me a whole long answer about the AI bot, what her chat bot, whatever it is on this one, went into a whole apologetics thing for it. But it had a few quotes that I thought were interesting. One, these models have been extensively tested against historical data. We'll talk about that later. And it would be irresponsible to ignore or to dismiss it as a one-factor theory. Yet, that's what we do when we limit it to, we limit this discussion to CO2. They'll always say, well, the sun isn't sufficient to cause this warming. So anyways, a little going, stepping back a ways, looking at the sun's contribution to our climate, sun puts out about that many watts. That's a lot. And then the earth being one unit away, we're defined by us, gets about 1396 watts per meter squared. Mars is only 50% farther away. It gets about 600 watts per meter squared because of the way that the factors work. And then Mercury, much closer, 84. So we're obviously not moving to Mercury. It is kind of funny that people talk about that Earth might become uninhabitable and we'll have to move to Mars, which has, very little sun. So the moon, stepping in a little bit closer, the moon is about negative 81 plus or minus 333 degrees Fahrenheit. So not a very habitable place. And that's important because it's about the same average distance away. So sometimes it's a little closer to the sun. Sometimes it's a little farther from the sun. But average distance, it's about the same. And you can see what effectively the moon has for temperature swings without an atmosphere. Now, if we look at our Earth, we say, well, the average temperature without an atmosphere is going to be about 8 degrees Fahrenheit. And with an atmosphere, it's about 59 or 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And then we go back to the moon and say, well, the moon is minus 414 to 253, where the Earth is minus 100 to plus 120. So the difference being that there's an atmosphere. And we have to look at, does the atmosphere make the planet warmer or cooler? So it's always, they look at this and they say, well, 8 Fahrenheit to 59 or 60 degrees Fahrenheit, it's making the atmosphere makes the planet warmer. It does, but it also makes the planet cooler. So what it does is it's moving that energy around the atmosphere instead of like the moon. So so just to say that the atmosphere warms the Earth is not really accurate. And then one thing, if you look at the atmosphere and consider just how thin it is and what it is the buffer between us and space at about minus 455 degrees. And if you consider how thin the atmosphere is, and I just did it for grins, if you look at about 50,000 feet, which usually encompasses the troposphere, which is where we have our weather, and then you bring that down to a 1 foot or 30 centimeter globe, the atmosphere on a 1 foot globe that you'd see in a classroom is about three sheets of paper. So, you know, consider that between Earth and the cold void of space is literally paper thin. We really don't have any trouble losing heat whatsoever. Mars, this is going out again, and this is to look at the atmosphere and the effect of carbon dioxide. If we look at Mars and we say, well, Mars has on Earth, we have 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, and we're just taking a sample. We're taking a box size sample of a million molecules. Well, Mars has an atmosphere of about 1% of Earth. So inside that same size box, you'd only have 10,000 molecules. But 95% of those molecules are CO2. So 9,500 molecules in the same space that Earth has 400, Mars has 9,500. So it has almost 2,000% more carbon dioxide molecules. Yet Mars's average temperature is negative 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's 50% farther away. It's only 50% farther away, but it has 2,000% more CO2. So it seems the carbonistas would want to not go to Mars at any point just because of the high concentrations of CO2. But if CO2 was actually trapping heat, like the climate gullible believe, then you would have Mars, which should be warm by now. Our carbon dioxide is measured from atop a volcano in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it's been going up since they started reliable measurements in the mid-1950s, and it was about 280. Now, I'll talk about it again later, but 200 is about where photosynthesis breaks down. So it doesn't matter how much sun you have, photosynthesis breaks down at about 200 parts per million. So 280, we're really, really on the ragged edge. And one thing that as the planet warms, the water outgasses carbon dioxide. So outgassing carbon dioxide. So where is this? Well, it's on a volcano, extinct volcano, I guess, or inactive volcano in the middle of the ocean. So if the Pacific Ocean is getting any warmer and outgassing any CO2, I would expect that the CO2 would be increasing. And then these little variations in there, you can see just how much that growth cycle is. So that up to down is in that area. When it's in the growth cycle, that it's really trying to pull that CO2 down. And measurements began 63 years ago. So not a real long time. And if we look at the historical record, we see very warm periods and we see cold periods, and the cold periods and the low carbon dioxide did not go well. We're down here, obviously nowhere near any of the our warm periods that happen to also have high carbon dioxide, which makes plants grow. So if we look at our trace gases, this is where they will talk about this, that carbon dioxide is most of the trace gases that make up that 1%. And that, but the atmospheric composition of that, those trace gases go down to less than 1%. Nitrogen is 78 and oxygen 21. Fortunately, those do not, those are transparent to us. And if you look at the overall picture, but one thing that you'll notice is missing here, because I talked about on the first slide, is that, so there's your carbon dioxide. It is that we're talking about dry air. So anytime that they're talking about the greenhouse gases, they'll generally limit it to carbon dioxide. Well, carbon dioxide is only 10%, but if you eliminate that 90%, then it all of a sudden becomes 100%. So, and then the methane, which is a very, very small part, much smaller than carbon dioxide, as well as ozone, then they become, they barely become relevant, but the trick is to get rid of it and consider only dry air when water vapor does most of that. And we're not going to get rid of our water vapor because our surface is over 3/4 water. And then going back to Dr. Happer's statement, that at least 90% of the greenhouse warming is due to water vapor and clouds. And so so that is eliminated typically right off the bat. So just real quick, I did these to help me understand them, just for perspective. And if you look at where we are now, we are at this green line here. We're at the blue line here, 400 parts per million. That was around 2018 when I put this together. And the Little Ice Age, when we started measuring you know, or supposedly it was around 280 parts per million, but that's where we started. Little Ice Age was probably lower than that. And if you look at here, if you look in the middle here, where basically, you know, plants die, and that is massive famine, and that explains all of the deaths during the cold parts. If you go out here again, 400 parts per million, the red line, of course, is where, you know, they tell us that all hell will break loose unless the UN takes complete control of our life. But if we look out here in this green band is where plants, at least under this this atmospheric pressure that we have, is plants are optimized. So greenhouses will put a lot of money into getting their greenhouses up to about 1,500 to 2,000 parts per million just to make the plants grow. So obviously the plants have been optimized to grow at that. And this blue circle here is what the crazy prehistoric jungles. So the earth has been significantly more. And if we look at this orange dot, I talked about that before, this orange dot here is the grow season fluctuation. So that's how much it fluctuates in a year from season to season. And if we look down here, the human contribution is much smaller on an annual basis than even the grow contribution. And the U.S. contribution is down here. So whatever's going on, our contribution is very little. So they tend to you know, talk about how much carbon dioxide is being put into the air, but they never talk about it in terms of perspective globally. CO2 is plant food. When you look at it, the Sahara is greening. And that's because more carbon dioxide means the plants do a better job of retaining water, so they don't have to use as much water because their stoma are not open. So most of the greening is done probably in places that we're not going to see it, but around the Sahara Desert. So a lot of those places probably lost a lot of their green when they went down to an ice age. We lost a lot of CO2. Of course, they'll talk about some of these places where they're, for whatever reason, that the green is going down. So right now we have unknown costs of going to net zero. We know it's going to be, would be trillions of dollars. Our climate goals are CO2 goals with no impact on climate. And that's one of the things that they'll say, well, our climate goals are our carbon dioxide goals. And when I ask the expert and say, okay, what is that going to do? They all say, we don't know. It's just we have these climate goals, which then we say are carbon dioxide goals, but we don't actually know what they do. When we talk about getting our experts coming in, talking about $100 eventually, it's much higher now, is maybe getting it someday down to $100 to sequester a ton of CO2. Well, one gigaton of CO2 would be $100 billion, and that'd be literally pumping it into a hole in the ground. And that would be one gigaton out of over 3,000 gigatons in the atmosphere. So that's a very low percentage, 1/3,000th. Now, this is from some MIT slides. So just a different way to look at it. It talks about here that the evaporation, 78 watts per meter squared, is what leaves. And so if you look at the way they state it, on average, evaporation from the surface carries away 78 watts per meter squared. Infrared radiation carries away 66 watts per meter squared. So just in terms of looking at it a different way, evaporation, 54% carried away. Infrared is 46% carried away. Of that, CO2 is less than 10%. Human combustion of all hydrocarbons. And then the U.S. is about 15% of that. So you get roughly the same answer, 0.007%. So about 7 parts in a million, or 100,000. That's the total U.S. contribution. And then this down here is a cartoon I did for explaining the power of evaporation. If you look at the energy moved in evaporation in about 30 seconds in a day, globally, that amount of evaporation removes all of the heat of all of the hydrocarbon use daily. So daily hydrocarbon use by humans, that heat is removed in less than 30 seconds in a day by evaporation. Now here we look at this is a Planck energy curve, and this red is the incoming radiation. This is the high energy incoming, and this is all normalized, so you can see that the height of this and the height of this are the same. So what they do is they just divide them by the max amplitude, so you get one. So if this is a million, then you divide it by a million, you get one. If this is a one and you divide it by one, you get one. And then it's also logarithmic. So it's fine. You just have to know what you're looking at. So this is most of the incoming radiation because of the greenhouse gas. Very little of the greenhouse radiation is absorbed. So that means that radiation all just hits the Earth and is absorbed by the Earth and Earth and water. And then over here, what you see is you see the energy that's leaving, and this blue area is what's the infrared window, and that leaves straight away. So the energy and the blank area under the curve is what's absorbed. Now, if you look at a real Planck energy curve, looks like this is what it looks like. This is our sun's temperature here, surface temperature, somewhere around 5,000 degrees Kelvin. And you can see how when you notch off the temperatures, it drops off drastically. So this is kind of cool because you can see from our where we are in the visible light spectrum, the spectrum that we see is the highest energy of in the spectrum. And then the infrared, the out heat, it's well for the energy long wave IR leaving the Earth. It's well out here past 4 and 5. As you can see here, you have, I think 5 out here, 5 is here. So this is where that graph stops. So these get very small. You wouldn't even see these bumps on this one here. So this is where we are again. And this is what we have to look at when we're looking at spectral absorption, because the CO2 effect is how much energy it absorbs from the spectrum. And so first of all, we look at water vapor and we see that it's got all of these areas that it absorbs water. And then down here, we'll look at carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide absorbs a little bit here in that in the incoming radiation spectrum, but you can see the energy there is pretty close to zero. It does absorb some. And then the next one is here, and the energy is about actually zero. So it absorbs a lot of the energy where there's no energy to be absorbed. And then here again, you have some energy absorbed, but it's relatively zero. And then over here, and so again, those are all pretty close to zero energy absorbed. And then in here, this bandwidth, carbon dioxide, that's where carbon dioxide absorbs. But one, you can see what water vapor absorbs in this area. And you can also see that the spectrum is pretty much totally contained right there. So you could add carbon dioxide here. And if the temperatures go up, what you'll also have is higher levels of humidity, and you'll have a better absorber. So you can really add more carbon dioxide and not have any effect. And then if you want to look at methane, because now they're freaking out about that. Methane is down here, absorbs almost all the energy in a low and a zero energy band. And then it absorbs in this area, which has a high total absorption, almost all saturated, but again, water vapor, which is much more prevalent. Methane is in the parts per billion. It's about 2 parts per million, where water vapor is about 40,000 parts per million. So much higher. So water vapor takes all that energy up. So again, the whole trick, the deception, is to use dry air. So if we look at atmospheric energy again, that part leaves, that's a window of 15 to 35%. Leaves, we call it 20%, 90% is water vapor, 10% is CO2, 1% of that is man-made, less than 15% of that is, that's where we get our U.S. contribution, again, a 0.015%. Colorado contribution, even less. This picture shows the how much there is, and this black line here is where we are at the shows the absorption at 400 parts per million, and the red line shows 800 parts per million. And it's a little easier to see on this logarithmic graph. And one thing that you have to recognize is that here, below 200 parts per million, that's where you get increasing photosynthesis becomes increasingly difficult to impossible. I think around 150, it is pretty much the hard line end, but most plants are going to die less than 200. And if plants die, then that does not bode well for people. So we're about 1% above that. So energy-wise, at 280 parts per million, which is where it was when we started 63 years ago, and it was on the rise coming out of all of the famine and all of that, all of the bad that we had, 1%, we're only about 1% energy-wise above that. And if we go out to 500, because it's easy with a line, you get to 260, and that's about 2% more. And if you go all the way out to 1,200 parts per million, basically tripling what we have now, we would have about 4% more energy from carbon dioxide, which could be, but you have to put that in perspective. So I'm just going to blow that up. We have cell death down here, and then we have 230 parts per million. So you have to look at that and go, well, there's about six of those under there. So let's look at it in perspective. So we're just going to stack all those up so you can see it. That cell death right there, that would be tripling our CO2. That would be doubling. That's about where we are right now. And that's the CO2 level we're around where we were at. So if we do this again, and then I'm just going to take that box and use it for size perspective, because perspective, I think, is what we've lost overall. And I'm just going to rebuild that over there. But that is less than 10%. That's less than 10% of our greenhouse gas effect. So let's add in the water vapor. That's over 90%. So it's going to shift into the green a little bit, but just for this, we'll do 90 and 10. Approximately 1% is anthropogenic, like we talked about. So that's that amount of the CO2. 15% comes from the USA. And then that little dot there was from Colorado. So if you can't see that, if you didn't see that, that little bump right there is the amount of, in this case, how much Colorado greenhouse gas effect can reduce greenhouse effect on the way to killing everything. So now going back to, we really can't do much, but we're spending trillions of dollars. And in the process of spending trillions of dollars, we're causing, like right now, we've caused the prices of everything to double and triple. So everybody's worried about the price of rent, the price of food. Well, all of that is energy dependent, and all of that has gone up because we're worried about this. And as you can see, that is literally less than a blip on there. I think I figured it out. It's like the energy equivalent of about less than a second of the sun's arc as it goes up. Now, the Carrington effect, we had a Carrington event in the 1800s, and we missed one a couple of years ago, and it would knock out all of the electric grids. So the other ancient wisdom to consider is don't put your eggs all in one basket. Otherwise, people will die from this. And if we look at the solar variability, you can see it on here. And if you look at this scale here, it's just in there. So you can see that the sun is not a constant output. And if you just draw kind of a line, an estimated line, then you can see that it's been increasing, sometimes more than others. And this right here is around when we started the Industrial Revolution, and over here is where the Little Ice Age was. So everything, the CO2 level was, it was really cold. The CO2 level was down. There was lots of famine, lots of death. And why the Carbonistas and Greeniacs decide that that's the place we want to go back to as soon as possible, I don't understand, but it does not bode well. 1 watt per meter squared. If you look at this difference here, it's about 1 watt per meter squared. And if you look at that across the surface of the earth, that's about the equivalent of 21,000 barrels of oil per second. or about 2 Hiroshima events per second. That's a lot of heat. And so you're, even at just 1 watt per meter squared, you're adding a significant amount of heat. One reason that they estimate, like, that creates a problem in the narrative is that I think since about 2000, that there hasn't been any significant temperature increase. And if you look at this graph, you think, that could be going down. You kind of see that on this same graph. Will it come back up again? Well, let's hope so, because we don't want to continue down this path. Now, one thing on the NOAA page, they talk about how that the sun is not enough and that the carbon dioxide is going up as it gets warmer. But if we look across this mean, we say, okay, there it is. Well, you know, it's getting warmer, and this is another NOAA page that I thought was interesting. And the main thing that I thought was interesting when in preparing this brief is this thing down here where it says there's no data. Now, I thought that's really strange. You've got data all the way from out here to show the greenhouse dropping down, or the glacial mass going down, but no data right here. But there is data, and that data is right there, and it shows it going up. So clearly the reason that they put this, that they took this no data here, is it was, there's no data right there that they want to show, because it disrupts the narrative, because the carp, there's no other reason for it. And then you could look at this where it was actually higher and variable. You wonder where that data is. Oh, that data is over here. So this is a common thing that you see with the Carbonistas and the Greeniacs, that they will cull the data or change the data. And then this also caught my attention, because I did I looked mathematically when I was teaching math at the as a differential equation, the change of energy constant volume, and that's a disk is pi r squared h, and I did a cartoon on that right there as well to explain that. And what you get, if you have a linear decrease in ice, it goes down linearly. But if you have an ice mass that's a disk or a mass of ice or a cube or whatever, it looks like it melts linearly for a while, and then it drops off suddenly. If you look at these are the same amount of volume being reduced over a long time. So as you can see, what would you expect mathematically if you had a constant energy like 1 watt per meter squared that was melting the ice? Well, you would expect mathematically, you should expect that it to look linear and then drop off suddenly all at once. And if you want to look at that, that's the link to that. It's about 3 minutes. Solar variability, again, just for perspective, this is about how much sun hits the earth. This is how much after the albedo, which is roughly 30%. So 30%, and that's just an estimate. It just depends on where you are on the on the Earth. So 1%, so plus or minus 1% is a huge change, and that plus or minus 1% well eclipses any energy contribution from humans. So the orange circle is just what actually kind of hits the Earth. The solar variability, because the Earth is not on a perfect ellipse, it's plus or minus 3%. So the farther away we are, then we subtract this disk. If we're closer in, we add that disk. Well, it's significantly more energy than the United States or the entire world contributes on a yearly basis. Here is where that's global fossil fuel use. So it doesn't even show up in terms of a perspective energy-wise as just how much energy changes back and forth between where the Earth is in its orbit. And then that's geothermal. That's the heat that's produced geothermally, still about twice what we produce from hydrocarbon conversion. And then this 1 watt per meter squared, again, this 1 watt per meter squared increase since the Industrial Revolution, that increase is about 10 times more, is about 10 times more. So we don't want to go back to that. And then again, if you look at what happens if the sun went out, does the carbon dioxide trap it? Within a week, the average global surface temperature would drop below zero, freezing. Photosynthesis would halt immediately, obviously. It doesn't matter how much CO2 you have. And then the microorganisms. So again, carbon dioxide does not trap heat. That's just something they say for the climate gullible. Millions of years after that, it would be a stable minus 40. So fortunately, we have an atmosphere. We do have greenhouse gases. And if we didn't, that would be bad. So it doesn't trap the heat. Really, what the molecules do is more like a, what I'd say is a pachinko machine. The heat drops in and then bounces around, but eventually it comes out, it leaves. And if you look at Bjorn Lundberg did this with, now he believes in, the man-made greenhouse. He just doesn't believe that it's cost-effective to do everything that they're trying to do. But anyways, just using the IPCC models, if the United States goes net zero today, cost of trillions of dollars, maybe by 2100, you could change the temperature by 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you look over here, you look over on the other side, if the entire rich world goes down, you could maybe lower it by 1 degree Fahrenheit, 0.96 degrees Fahrenheit. But what John Kerry has said is that we have to lower it by 3 degrees Fahrenheit. 1.5 degrees Celsius, roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit. So what this is saying is if all the rich countries in the world suddenly went to zero CO2, you could maybe reach one third of your goal. So probably ought to be looking more at adaptation. And carbon, the CO2 coalition, which I'd say is probably a little bit more credible, their estimates are a little bit lower than that. But even the wild-eyed IPCC estimates are pretty low. What causes this? This is a slide from the MIT model, and the black line was the model that they created, and I'll show you a little bit more on that. And then the green line is kind of an actual look at what the atmosphere actually does. And so they say, well, look at that. Our model pretty well matches what the actual atmosphere does, and that's really pretty cool. But if you look at this difference right here, it's about 96, so close to 100 degrees difference. So it's close to 100 degrees difference. And so what they do is they just say, well, we'll just subtract that. And then they move it all the way down. Well, if you move the black line down, then it gets well away from the atmosphere. So you can't, it's really pretty incredulous to say that you could make a model, have a 100 degree fudge factor, and then use it to predict 3 degrees or even half a degree in that same scale. Here's one of their things, this Stefan Boltzmann constant here. They assume that the atmosphere absorbs the energy and then radiates like a black body, but the law is only for perfect radiators. Stars are about 90 to 95%. Gases are much lower because they have a very punctuated spectrum. If you look at the spectrum, you can see where the energy is. So they consider for their model, they consider that the atmosphere is radiating like a black body on a continuous spectrum when carbon and carbon dioxide are down here. So it's very disturbing. One of the things this goes to Dr. Happer's quote to me, that where there are pigs, where there's a trough, there will be pigs. And if you look at the Geneva principles, what they're throwing money at is understanding the scientific basis of risk of human-induced climate change. So the only thing that they're focused on is human-induced climate change, and that is going to be CO2. So that explains why they focus on CO2. It doesn't justify their hand waving around. But you can see, if you say, well, humans only create 3 parts in 1 million of carbon of greenhouse gas effect, then that funding is going to dry up pretty quick. So again, what they're trying to find is, what they're being paid to find is human-induced climate change, and that's what they're going to find. going back, these models have been the AI bots, our savior. These models have, artificial intelligence. These models have been extensively tested. Well, here's the hockey stick graph. But then as Dr. Happer shows, the reality is much different, because all they did was they just took out the inconvenient facts in this area to create the graph that they wanted and create the scare that they wanted. The hockey stick has nothing to do with reality, but was the incorrect handling of proxy temperature records. So model versus temperature, you can see the black line is the 100 model average. And then the lines below it are satellite analysis. So they are going up. They do correspond a little bit. And then after you add some more data points in here, they'll make them better. But it's not this black line is not predictive, which is the point of scientific model is to be predictive. And this is not predictive. So it's not really a model. And that's reality. So here we have our climate models, and here we have our reality. Again, the model is not predictive, and therefore it's not even scientific. Here we have our model, and here we have our observations. So again, these are not, they don't correspond, and this red line has absolutely nothing to do with modeling or predicting reality. And the purpose of models is to be able to predict. Another thing would be the increase in forest fires. Well, a little down from here, but probably cite them from here, that they've increased. And that's, you can see where they were before we started our forestry practices. Now we're starting bad forestry practices, and our forest fires are going up and causing more damage. Talked about this, the Carrington event back in the 1800s caused spark discharges, telegraph paper set that on fire. Even when the telegraphers were disconnected, the batteries powering the line, aurora-induced electric current, the wire still allowed messages to be transmitted. So this is one of those things where it's really foolish to put all our eggs in one basket. So to say that we want to have an all-electric grid is just saying that we want to be one Carrington event away from completely annihilating them. And one thing, like with solar panels are designed to absorb radiation. So I doubt a solar. So if we increase our acreage of millions of acres of solar panels as needed, they could be wiped out instantly by one small EMP or an EMP from a solar flare. This is a disturbing one. This is from 1991. This is Jacques Cousteau talking about it's terrible to have to say this. World population must be stabilized. And to do that, we must eliminate 350,000 people a day. So this is as a spokesman for the UN and the UNESCO courier. That was much higher than the rate of death at the time. And that was at a much lower population level. I don't remember the population level in 1991, but in 1991, the UN, Jacques Cousteau speaking on behalf of the UN, was saying we need to eliminate 350,000 people a day to reach some sustainable. Well, things like, turning nitrogen from the atmosphere into fertilizer using natural gas has made the Earth's population be able to sustain more population, which is also something they're trying to get rid of. So that's a little terrible to say. If you look at pollution stuff, a large part of our pollution comes from China over here. Of course, there's no sensors out here. But all of these trade winds, this is how when we had the balloons a couple last year, every now and then you hear about them, they just put the balloons on the trade winds and it wafts over here. So about upwards of 70% of our pollution comes from China. We know that. And then this one is, I think, sulfur dioxide. So this is a Windy app, which you can get online. It's really pretty cool. Windy.com online. So you can see where these pollutions are. So again, the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace aligned, alarmed, and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. So this is something that has not changed in politics because it's something that's ongoing. And that's why I'd say the politicians are reluctant to acknowledge the truth, because the believing in the lie and being able to make that appeal to authority to say, well, the scientists say, and you'll notice that Al Gore always said, well, the scientists tell us. Well, let the scientists tell us directly. Let the scientists stand up for themselves. But the politicians love it because it allows them to have an existential crisis, and an existential crisis requires existential solutions. And they just tie everything back to the existential solutions to create their totalitopia legislatively. Again, it's hard to get a man to understand something. His salary depends upon his not understanding it. So we have that. And then, of course, where there is a trough, there will be pigs. And what I'd like to do is trying to reduce the number of useful idiots, who is a person that's easy to persuade and believe things to help a particular group or person politically, naive or credulous, or does not comprehend the cause's goals, or the person is cynically being used by the cause's leaders to advance a cause or political agenda. When I asked my students at the Air Force Academy how much carbon dioxide they thought was in the atmosphere based on everything they'd learned, what was interesting is that some cadets refused to even answer it anonymously for fear of whatever retaliation. I don't know. And then, but the average was about 36 to 40%. So based on the fear that had been driven into their heads about carbon dioxide, they estimated that the carbon dioxide was about 40% of the atmosphere. And when they find out that it's 0.04% of the atmosphere, then one cadet I overheard just said, then why do we even worry about it? And that's exactly it. So I think, my apologies for not being anywhere near the level of a Dr. Happer or a Dr. Lenzen in terms of quality, but hopefully I was able to, dumb down climate science a little bit. And I'm still trying to get it dumb enough to politician level.
I'm just really impressed that you as a politician can speak out like this. And I'm just wondering, how's this going over with your voters? Do people are they pushing back against you, or what do they think about it?
Mostly support. I mean, the people that voted for me are tired of this. Are tired of the nonsense. I do get a little. I get surprisingly little pushback even in the House. They don't like to hear it when I bring it up. And the idea of delisting carbon dioxide as a pollutant. The totalitopians voted that down right away, but I was able to bring it up in the House, and I have asked for it, and they just kind of, the reaction is just to basically look away. They won't engage the science even after I've told them and I've explained it. I've said, this is what I'm doing. I'm asking for you to challenge. I'm writing this down, phone a friend, call all your, when I presented the bill, either HB 23, 1063 or 1163, I don't remember exactly, but I sent it out and I said, send it to the oil and gas, send it to the, all of the energy places that come in and tell us about our carbon dioxide and our climate goals. And their answer was, we don't have the expertise to answer this. And it's like, so, which I think kind of means that they know it's right, but their paycheck depends on their not knowing that it's right. So they just said, we don't have the expertise for it. So, I mean, you can't really get any more simple, more basic than just the percentages of it. We know it's 10%. We know how much. And when I asked we had the carbon dioxide experts come in on carbon dioxide sequestration. That's where I got the numbers for the $100 billion. I said, well, how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere? And these are the carbon dioxide experts. These are the experts in carbon dioxide. And they said, well, I don't know. I can tell you how much carbon dioxide that we've put into the atmosphere, but I don't know how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. And then just the other day, I was listening to a conference on methane, and one of the representatives not a scientist, but he likes to pretend he's one. He cited that, the carbon dioxide that we put out is going to stay in the atmosphere for thousands, centuries or thousands of years. And, on one of the bills justified that the enslavement of children in third world countries was okay so that we could have electric vehicles. And that was necessary. Their enslavement was necessary for that, because we have to have our electric vehicles. So we can't not have third world countries enslaved in the mining of cobalt.
I want to make sure I understood you there. You're saying that people who are in the carbon sequestration business, they didn't know how much CO2 is in the air? That's mind-blowing.
I had no idea. And it's very difficult to find out. I mean, try Googling it. Try finding it online. I mean, it took a while to find out a relationship between, parts per million in the atmosphere and how many, and what that relates to in terms of tonnage. It's just like this AI bot and more, so as that gets, I'm sure the results are going to get more and more difficult to find, because clearly the AI bot thinks that we need to believe that carbon dioxide is destroying the planet.
Did this come up a lot in the campaign in 22, or do you think it's going to come up? I don't know if you have debates about it or anything in 24, or is it kind of not even in the top 5 or 10 issues that people are talking about for the next election?
It does come up. The totalitopians, they don't want to talk about it because they don't know anything about it. They just want to pass laws based on it, but they can't answer any questions. So I am trying to, keep it brought up because it's relevant. I think most everybody has kind of given up, and they've just kind of accepted that we're going down this path. And, they don't, like, most people know that the whole global warming, and you have to be careful in here, because I'd say, okay, the climate is changing and I think it's probably getting warmer. That doesn't mean it's carbon dioxide. It doesn't mean it's the, and now, this whole conference that I listened to the other day trying to, talk about methane and reducing methane emissions. Well, methane is a fraction of a fraction of carbon dioxide, which is irrelevant in terms of water vapor. So, but they're making tons of money on it. And when I asked them those questions about, because they said methane was 25%. And so, well, methane is about 0.5% of the carbon dioxide. So even if it's 80%, 80 times more, even if it's 80 times more efficacious in terms of greenhouse gas effect, then how does that work that we got 25% of global warming? And then, then I just got the from Weissman, then Goldfein, I think, but I got just, oh, well, we can't really answer that. There's a scientist that wrote a paper and he told, and undoubtedly it's a factor that's based on dry air. They take dry air and eliminate water vapor right away. And they have reasons for it. They said, well, water vapor goes in and out of the atmosphere so rapidly that it doesn't have the same effect. And so that's why they'll say, well, carbon dioxide that's man-made will stay in the atmosphere for thousands of years. So then it's just sitting there, just absorbing, more. Well, the power of the evaporation is that it takes that heat up, brings it to a drier air, supercools the water, and then brings it back down. So it's a pretty phenomenal cycle. Again, that link for that cartoon is in there. I think it's, I was quite astonished by how much energy, and that's a very conservative estimate because it didn't include any freezing. So it's a phenomenal amount of energy that's moved by water vapor, and it's just taken right off the top to make it a single variable problem, which is carbon dioxide.
So do you feel kind of alone as a politician with your level of knowledge about this, or have you had a chance to talk to people either locally, other politicians, locally or nationally, to try to gauge how much they know about this?
I'm trying to do more connection with some politicians in other areas. I'd say I'm probably one of the few that's actually studied it. I can't think of his name, but he's a senator up in Montana. You know, much more versed than I am. You know, an actual scientist, Robinson, Senator Art Robinson. That's his, you know, I don't know if I can show it here, but that's his book here. He's, you know, he's an actual scientist in this regard. So I've had some correspondence with him, not a whole lot. And then, so just trying to connect on the Republican side, I'd say not a high degree of understanding, you know, an understanding that it's all, you know, nonsense, but not an understanding of why. And on the Democrat side, I'd say there's like no understanding of the science, just an eagerness to embrace the amount of legislation that they can base on it.
I'm just looking this up. That Art Robinson you mentioned, is he the guy behind the petition project?
One of them, yep. Yep, there's a CO2 Coalition has a petition. He's the one that I think did the 10,000 of them.
I'm amazed I did not know that. Excellent. Okay.
That was fast Google work.
Thank you. Any other points you'd like to make before we go ahead and wrap up?
I'd say that the time frame for hoping that sanity will somehow interject itself, you know, talking to people in the oil and gas, you know, they'll say, yeah, we know this is crazy. And then some of them are getting into the carbon sequestration doing that, you know, it's like, well, I think they look at it and it's like, well, it's easier to tap the, you know, if, you know, they'll extract money from the ground or they'll extract money from people's imaginations. But, you know, people need to get at least a little bit smart on this and understand and then push back and ask the hard questions of their politicians and note that they're going to defer, or deflect from them, but, they need to challenge it and they need to stop just hoping that it will go away, because I guarantee from the height, in the House of Representatives, it was on the same slavery vote that justified slavery, is that, you know, we might only have decades to live. Well, we might only have, you know, the earth will be gone in decades if we don't have child slavery in the third world. And just the level of crazy that was behind is there is not going away anytime soon. And then, you know, here in Colorado, I mean, these people are all, I'd say they're pretty much selected by Jared Polis. So, they're, you know, that's part of the entire agenda, whether Jared actually believes it or not, I don't know. Or if it's just useful to, promote his totalitarian agenda, I don't know. He's obviously a smart guy, but.
All right. On that note, I think we will finish up. But thank you very much, Ken DeGraff. I enjoyed talking to you. Appreciate it.